You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 9th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and indeed review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, we'll be discussing the hits and misses from Venice and Toronto film festivals.
We are bound together by God, and this can only be broken by a crime against God.
Something's happened.
Not something, everything.
It would be a sin to help you destroy yourself.
That was a clip from Joe Wright's new adaptation of Anna Karenina, which has been screened in Toronto and is rather dividing opinions. We'll be dissecting this and many other new titles with film critic Karen Krasanovich.
And from film, we move to art, and later in the show, we'll be joined in the studio by Ben Luke, arts critic for the London Evening Standard. He's been casting his critical eye over some of the standout exhibitions in the city.
We'll also be getting some reading recommendations from the Shahdam Children's Centre in Moscow.
Most parents, they still think that Russian fairy tales or Russian books of Soviet times are better.
And if you're wondering what to do this weekend, look no further. We've pulled together the weekend's cultural highlights from around the world, followed by a special look ahead from Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's culture programme is packed this weekend. Two standout exhibitions include a photography retrospective and the VA Gallery's Made in China exhibition.
And we'll be playing some of the latest releases from Uruguay-based record label International Feel when we speak to its founder, Mark B, for our weekly music review.
So lots to look forward to on this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
There is indeed a great deal to look forward to. Gillian, some of the stuff we're talking about you have seen some of.
I know. I decided to do my homework and I spent Friday putting my laptop away, and I went to the White Tube and I went to Larry Gagosian and I went to the cinema to have a look at one of the films we're going to be talking about. But now it's so sunny, so I'm sort of parking all my sort of gallery going in films because I'm going to spend the day in the sun, I think. And what about you? What are you going to be doing?
I have been mostly broadcasting from here during evenings this week.
I've been seeing you.
Exactly. But I am going to see a thing tonight. I'm going to see Leonard Cohen at Wembley. Ooh. Which is the good news. The bad news is, unfortunately, it's at Wembley Arena, which I'm not sure is going to be the most conducive.
It's such a shame because to see Leonard Cohen is a dream, but in a big, big space, you just kind of long for that intimacy, don't you?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how he's... I'm intrigued to see at least how he will overcome that, though I can't imagine... I think the last act I saw at Wembley Arena voluntarily was AC/DC, and I can't imagine that Leonard Cohen is going with the whole cannons, exploding staircases and enormous inflatable strippers. But I could be pleasantly surprised.
Well, let's move on now, because we have Karen in the studio. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
The Venice Film Festival wraps up later today with the announcement of the winner of the much-coveted Golden Lion Award. Over the Atlantic, the Toronto International Film Festival, known to its friends as TIFF, is in full swing now.
And to talk us through what's been happening at both and to give us her take on the hits and misses premiered at Venice and Toronto, we're joined now in the studio by film critic Karen Krasanovich. Welcome, Karen.
Hi there.
I'm always intrigued. You know, there's always competition amongst the films, but there's competition amongst the film festivals as well. What's the difference between Venice and Toronto?
Well, there's a lot of difference, actually. Venice is the world's oldest film festival, although I have to say Edinburgh is the oldest continuous film festival. So yes, for us, not to be competitive, but it has a certain tang. Every film festival has its own, I suppose, brand we would call it now, but a flavor. Toronto used to be sort of a smaller one. You know, it was Toronto, it was America. You know, it was not America, it was Canada, and it's actually become. I think actually 9/11 helped it a great deal because stars didn't necessarily want to travel over here. You know, dangerous crossing the water. So the difference now is not only proximity and timing, but it's also, weather actually plays an important role, and also where it comes in the festival sort of calendar. Because whenever, if you're ever trying to schedule your own festival, I actually did think about this. I wanted to, I'm not going to go into my idea, but I couldn't find a weekend where there wasn't, or a week where there wasn't actually a festival happening somewhere in the globe. There's always a film festival that's short or animated or whatever. So Venice for a long time was considered the art house, the sort of sensible, beautiful art house festival where the stars would go because, you know, it's Venice and it's beautiful.
The glamour.
And Toronto was always kind of a little workhorse, you know. Toronto, it's the grid system and we're all going to be real dutiful. And there's a bit of a Puritan ethic there.
Both cities kind of conforming to their stereotypes.
Well, and, you know, the reason they're stereotypes is a little bit of them is true, you know. A little bit of that is true. But Toronto now has become really very central, not only because it's easier to get to New York, L.A., but also it's a much easier city kind of to get around, and I think there's a lot less. I mean, when I went, this was probably some time ago. There wasn't that much bureaucracy with the older festivals like I mean, Berlin is beautifully run, but Cannes, for example, can be very very bureaucratic.
But isn't it interesting with Toronto? I mean, why everyone wants their film there is it's a great barometer to what's going to do well at the Oscars. And they've had an amazing track record of films that have done well there have gone on to win best Oscars.
Well, that's true, actually. And I think that that's the timing in the schedule. If you look at this, people release films if they want them Oscar-worthy. And, you know, there's always a little, we don't know what's really going to make it. We like to think we know what the criteria are. But usually releasing a film, sometimes in November, October, is usually good for when the Oscars come up next year.
But the big difference, I think, is that it's a public festival, where a lot of the other festivals are industry. So you really can gauge it, all the people, normal, everyday people who are going to be seeing films. So it's a good gauge of public opinion.
Well, there are. I mean, people can still, I mean, they can still sneak in. I mean, people do go to Cannes and do these other, I mean, Berlin is I keep talking about Berlin because I'm always amazed what Berlin pulls out of its hat. But yes, and also it's as I said, Toronto, in a way, in the venue of the city, actually makes it easier for the public to go and see things. You're right.
So what have you been seeing that's impressed you or spectacularly unimpressed you?
Well, the great thing is, I mean, I don't go to a lot of festivals anymore. I used to go to quite a few. And after a while, you know, if you're a film critic here and they sort of know you long enough, you get to see things ahead of time anyway. Mm. So you don't actually have to go to San Sebastian and eat the lovely pinchas to see movies. You can actually see them here. So
And then you can just go to San Sebastian and enjoy yourself without seeing any films.
You can. I don't know how to do that. but I think what Venice has got going for it, and I think we're going to find out later on today, we've got the Paul Thomas Anderson, The Master, which was supposed to be based on Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, and his Genesis. But of course, he's denying it, and then he's not denying it.
Well, of course he's denying it because they are famously litigious.
Oh, yeah.
Especially, and you can imagine them being especially sensitive about somebody making a film about them, given that Hollywood is where their money is.
Yes. Well, it's apparently an amazing, the film, the story, some people are kind of scratching their heads a little bit, but nobody can deny that the two central performances are really amazing. So that's good. This is from the maker of There Will Be Blood and Magnolia. Now, the front runner, they think, is going to be the Korean film. And I don't want to go talk about how the Australians call the Koreans, or good Koreans and bad Koreans. I don't want to get into that. Kim Ki-duk's Pieta, which is controversial. They're saying that it's very violent, has a lot of incest, whether that's real or not, I don't know. But that is actually, they consider the forerunner for the top prize in Venice. But there's a lot of really good things. For example, Spring Breakers, which is what the hangover for teenagers, you know, if that makes any sense. It's really, really full on. It's got some of the squeaky clean girls from some of the Disney films, Selena Gomez and Michelle Huggins. What's her name? Huggins. Can't remember her for her first name. I'm blanking it now. And it's done by Harmony Korine, who's the writer of Larry Clark's Kids.
And so is this a teen film with delusions of being more than a teen film?
I think this is a teen film that teens will really get. They'll say, yes, this is absolutely what it's like. And
which means presumably that, yes, parents
horrified.
Will be horrified. Yeah.
But it's always been the way. I mean, you remember when you were like 13 or something, you think, oh, this is great. You know, they're running around. Apparently it has more breast shots than most softcore porn. But it's all in the name of the story.
That should
she says with hand movements.
I said with hand movements. Exactly. Yes, they're still there.
That should encourage a teenage audience, certainly.
Oh, that's what it's designed for. But I think that the James Franco's performance is supposed to be astonishing. So.
I heard a lot of the people sort of left Venice early so they could make the beginning of Toronto. What are the big films at Toronto? What's the one you think is going to be creating the biggest buzz first?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's really early to tell because it looks like a lot of people. I mean, Venice was complaining that they didn't have enough stars on the red carpet. I think they were all kind of going to Toronto, which is shocking. There's wonderful, wonderful things there. Again, I mean, Spring Breakers and the Master is there. We've got The Place Beyond the Pines, which is by Derek Cianfrance, who did Blue Valentine. This is Ryan Gosling and Bradley Cooper in this. And I love, I heard a joke on Twitter. It was, when is Ryan Gosling going to be a goose? Is he going to grow up? I thought that was cute. I thought, yeah. Okay, we've got Dustin Hoffman's debut film, Quartet, which is starring Maggie Smith and Michael Gambon. Anna Karenina is actually going to be there. Great Expectations, Mike Newell's film.
So unwrap Anna Karenina for us, because that's just opened here, and it's about
And we do have a clip of that, which we can play.
Do you want to play the clip?
We'll play a clip of Anna Karenina, and then we will get into it further. Good. This is Anna Karenina.
We are bound together by God, and this can only be broken by a crime against God.
Something's happened.
Not something, everything.
It would be a sin to help you destroy yourself.
That's from Anna Karenina, which is a rather dividing opinion.
Very much so.
On which side of the divide is yours?
Well, I mean, there's a really interesting quote that Joe Wright, the director, has in the IMDb, if you want to look and read it. He says that he thinks that drama should not be real. It should have artifice. And I think that's the major complaint from this, is that it's all very artificial. It's all sort of stage set.
He does have half a point there, because that is also an awful lot of what Tolstoy was forever getting at, to what extent everybody's putting on a performance anyway. But does Joe Wright manage to bring any of that across, or has he slightly out-clevered himself? I'm asking as I don't have the advantage of actually having seen it.
And maybe explain a little bit what this artifice is.
Well, you've seen it. I mean, what did you think?
Well, what's interesting is it started as it was just going to be like a normal sort of location film. And then, you know, very close to production, he decided he had this vision that he was going to produce it all in studio. And it was almost going to be like a theater or a puppet theater to sort of mirror the society and the theater of the times. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of Baz Luhrmann, because you actually see it's like the Proscenium arches ripped away. And you see the pulleys and you see the backstage hands. And at first that sort of is kind of clever and intriguing. And I like when it suddenly cuts into the real, real filmic location. But then it just gets a bit bizarre, but beautifully shot, beautifully shot.
Well, I think I'd go along with that. I mean, I like that kind of artifice, and it depends really if you're in the mood or not. I think that it looks fantastic. The production design is amazing. I think the casting is great. I'm not really keen on Aaron Johnson personally, but I think that he's very well cast in this as sort of a shallow, lusty rogue. I mean, I think somebody was saying this is not a love story, this is a lust story. This is really what it's about.
My problem was I just don't find Keira Knightley that sort of sexy. I don't see the steaming broodiness of her. She looks great on screen, but more like a model. And I kind of wanted to feel the passion between them. And
did you want somebody fatter?
No. Yeah.
We wanted Nigella Lawson playing Angela. No, but I know what you mean. You want somebody that's not necessarily fleshier, but somebody maybe Marion Cotillard or
the steaminess.
Somebody
that really
looks like they would eat with their hands.
But Jude Law surprised me. I thought Jude Law surprised me because you imagine all these stars, they always seem to be playing themselves. And if you didn't know that was Jude Law, I think you might be fooled.
Well, I think what's very interesting about this is that he's, I mean, I'm sure it's not his real hair, but, you know, he is balding.
Bald.
He's balding.
Not his real baldness.
and you look at him, and it's like the first time you saw Billy Zane with his real hairs. And he's like, you know, we're so used. I was watching Cold Mountain the other day and looking at him and thinking, oh, you know, Jude. And I think he's actually making that transition into the older actor. rather than being the cute guy that starred in the remake of Alfie. I think it's starting
But it
to
kind
work.
Of shows him more as an actor, the kind of way you see him on theater and on stage as an actor, and you realize he's not just a movie star. He mm-hmm. is actually, he's a very good actor.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think that shows him off very well. And casting is so important in these things. It's as important as production design.
Is the casting one of the things that the people who haven't liked about it? Because it has been on the receiving end of some fairly brisk reviews.
I think people didn't like it because they didn't like the artifice. Mm. I think they found it very stagey, very awkward, or artificial. I don't think that they could feel, that they could get into the feeling of this. I mean, this is a very passionate story, and I think people just felt it one removed from it.
And the classic thing of, at the end of the day, do you care about Anna Karenina?
That's important. Yeah. It's important to care about. If you don't care about them, you're going to be thinking, oh, can I text in the cinema? Will anybody notice?
I'm texting.
Exactly, yeah. If you start shoe shopping while you're watching a movie, you're in trouble. That's my rule. If I start thinking about something else when I'm watching a movie, then I know the movie's in trouble.
So what else have you seen that's either made you think about shoe shopping or not made you think about shoe shopping?
Oh, gosh, okay, yes, that's right. I've got all this huge festival list here, and I've completely... What have I done with the list for this week? There we go. Okay, yes, this week now, it's a really interesting week. Obviously, Anna Karenina is the one that if you want to go to a dinner party and talk to people, that's the one to see. But there's a lot more there. There's the remake of Dredd, Judge Dredd, with Carl Urban. And apparently he doesn't take off I haven't actually seen it, but he doesn't take off his helmet.
What is the statute of limitations on remakes now?
There is none.
They do. They now seem to be appearing sort of a matter of days after the original.
Well, somebody was saying that they're actually going to remake Batman in about 4 years, so I guess they're starting now.
I was interested what you thought about Looper, because that's at the Toronto Film Festival again, and that's something that's going to be unraveling.
I saw that last night.
We do have a clip of Looper as well. Should we play a clip of that?
In the future, time travel is outlawed, used only in secret by the largest criminal organizations. When they need someone gone and they want to erase any trace of the target ever existing, they use specialized assassins like me, called Loopers.
Well,
did that give you any sense of what that film was about? This has been the much anticipated sci-fi time travel movie of this year, arguably. It's by director Rian Johnson, and it stars Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And the interesting thing about this is that, okay, when you start watching it, I mean, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's really, really transformed himself from his television days. I mean, he's a real leading man. But you're looking at his face... And it's actually quite good. It's a really good mix of sort of future apocalypse. And you can see like the 1%. It's like some people have all the really nice cars and other people have nothing.
And the rough premise of the film, what's the idea?
Oh, I don't want to give too much away.
Does Bruce Willis play a jaw-clenched, teeth-gritting tough guy in a singlet?
How did you know that? Dude, you're stealing my thunder now. Okay, I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to ruin it too much. So this is a spoiler. Turn away. Put your fingers in your ears. You'll be looking at him, and you'll say, he doesn't look right, he looks weird. He's been remade to look like Bruce Willis because Bruce Willis plays him in the future. So they are, in fact, each other. That hopefully doesn't, okay, come back now. doesn't ruin it too much. But it's the intricacies of how this all goes that works out. And at one point, you do have himself fighting himself across a diner table.
But you were talking earlier about the suspension of disbelief necessary to dissuade you from doing online shopping during films. The thing is, with time travel films, that's obviously more important than in most films, because it's got to be a good time travel film that stops you sitting there going, oh, hang on, and pointing out the obvious loopholes in the plot. Does it do that?
This one holds together. There was one point in the middle where I thought, what the heck is... And then it just kind of picked up again. I'm going to have to see it again because there was a slight disconnect. And this is what we call a problem with the story structure, where things don't make sense. But for the most part, yes, it makes sense. It's quite exciting. It uses the same kind of special effects that were used in Inception, not the folding of Paris, but the things flying up in the air. It is a really interesting story. Emily Blunt's fantastic in it. And really, I found it entertaining.
Okay. And has there been anything among your recent festival peregrinations which has made you wish you'd brought along a basket of last week's groceries?
Oh, God. You know what? Everybody's crowing about Taboo, and I really hate to hit an independent film, but I just couldn't bear it. It was awful. Miguel Gomez, and I, and it's a story, it's set in Africa, and then it moves to... It just went black and white and slow.
I can sense your will to live ebbing even as you speak about it.
We won't be booking that one, but I do think we... A lot of people
liked it, though.
Oh, well, we'll move on now. But Karen, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to the next time on The Review. And we go from film to books next, and we're going to be hopping over to Moscow, so stay tuned.
On Wednesday and Thursday next week, Monocle 24 heads to Helsinki. We'll be sitting down with the tastemakers behind the current world design capital in a city known for its design and architecture with the reputation of good quality of life, efficiency and high tech. It's not just vodka, Santa Claus and reindeer, you see. That's Midori House on Wednesday and Thursday next week, right here on Monocle 24. Kippis ja kuulemiin.
Bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bears.
You're cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we get some cultural offerings from the Venice Architecture Biennale and test our fortunes with a unique character from the old American fairground.
It's fascinating to see school-aged children just look up and wonder what she's going to say.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, where we have a lot less of the maniacal cackling than they clearly do on The Culture Show, with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Now, something we don't hear a lot about when we talk to our booksellers around the world is children's books. So for a bit of a change today, we're going to the Shardam Children's Center in Moscow. It's housed in a Soviet-era central house of artists, a long, low concrete box on the bank of the Moscow River. Not exactly the kind of location you'd expect to inspire anyone to creativity. At its centre is a children's bookshop, and Peter van Dijk went along to find out more about children's reading habits in Russia and asked Nika Parkomovska for some recommendations.
I used to work for children's publishing house and for adults publishing house as well. So for me, it's just like a heart of this place. But for many people coming here, it's also the center of Shardam, because it's like a place where they can sit down for a minute or for an hour and read something, discuss it with their children, because there are always people who talk to their children, finding some book and maybe not buying it, but reading it here. And this bookshop, we have quite nice choice of children's books and books for parents, like parenting books, and also all kind of stuff for creativity, you know, like brushes, so painting paper, everything children need to create something.
What books that are on the shelves now, what would you recommend to me to take home?
I would recommend Susanna Trout Berner books, which are they're translated into Russian from German, but they don't need actually any translation because it's picture books where there is a big town in all seasons of life, like four books for each season. And children, they adore them. They can spend hours and hours reading them. Actually, they don't read them. They just look, they talk. They describe what's going on, and they try to find small details, cats, dogs, people, and those books, I love them because they make your children think, talk, and sometimes even to paint. One of my favorite books in our bookshop, Philippa Pierce classics, which is called Tom and Midnight Garden, because when I've been to England more than 20 years ago for the first time, I learned about this book. I didn't know anything about it, and they compared it to Alice in the Wonderland of Winnie the Pooh, and I thought, oh wow, it can't be that great, but it is even better.
For children's literature, obviously for literature in general, Russia has a incredible literary tradition, but for children's literature, it doesn't seem to be so strong.
Okay, we don't have our Dickens or Michael Bond or Mark Twain, but Russian literature has really wonderful children's tradition coming from 20s. But now I don't find anything really that exciting among contemporary Russian writers, to be honest. But most parents, they still think that Russian fairy tales or Russian books of Soviet times are better because they teach you right things. They tell you about some wonderland which doesn't exist, but they believe that their children must have something like that in their minds, you know. I'm against that, and I think that you shouldn't teach your children something you don't believe in. So that's why I prefer English or American children's literature. But still, there are some very good illustrators in Russia, mostly in Soviet tradition, and we have reprints of some really great ones. Mainly they illustrated fairy tales and some books of 1950s or 1960s. But I would say that Russian literature is much bigger, yeah, than its general children's tradition. That's true, because like English literature is really great in both. You can compare Dickens' children's novels to Austen's or to his own adult novels. And talking about Russian literature, maybe only Pushkin is great in both.
And that was Nika Parkhomovska from the Sharman Children's Center in Moscow. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
And if you've been wondering what to do with yourself this weekend, look or indeed listen no further. Here's Monocle's resident Bulgarian, Nelly Gocheva, to tell you about some cultural highlights happening all around the world, from design in Brussels to dining in New York.
This weekend, London's Future Cinema will be transforming Barnes Common in southwest London into an all-singing, all-dancing tribute to the 1970s hit musical Grease. So expect real-life pink ladies, T-birds, plenty of leather, and a lot of summer loving. The screenings are scheduled for Saturday at 1800 and Sunday at 1700. In New York, the Exchange Alley restaurant is now open in Manhattan's East Village and promises to be more than a place to eat. Chef Paul Gerard and cocktail expert Billy Gilroy spent years working in New Orleans restaurants before opening this venture that adds a Louisiana twist to traditional New York flavors. You'll find jambalaya balls on the menu, plus an eclectic choice of German and American beers. This weekend sees the opening of a series of design-related events around Europe, from Helsinki Design Week to Maison Objet in Paris. If you're in Brussels, head to the annual Design September Festival taking place this month. You can choose from over 100 art and design events and check out the latest works by Tom Dixon, Patrick Juan and Ron Arad, to name a few. This year, all eyes are on graphic design with a number of dedicated exhibitions and workshops. Starting this weekend at Manhattan's David Turner Gallery is James Welling's Overflow. Comprised of three related bodies of work exploring photography's relationship to painting. Inspired by the work of late American artist Andrew Wyeth, Welling has recreated several of the painter's well-known compositions in photographic form. It is on until the 27th of October. And for your weekend soundtrack, we recommend Cat Power's comeback album, Sun. Easy, upbeat pop with electronic beats. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And for those listening in Hong Kong, stay especially tuned in, as later in the program, our bureau chief, Liv Lewichnik, will give her recommendations of what's happening this weekend in the city.
This is The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. It's now time for our weekly music review.
Now, International Field is a record label based in Punta del Este on Uruguay's Atlantic coast. It releases cover a range of genres from Balearic disco to deep house from a host of international artists. Its elusive founder, known only as Mark B, is originally from Sheffield in the north of England and had worked in the music industry for 15 years before he decided to found a record label.
To find out a bit more and to hear some of the label's new releases, we're joined by Mark on the line now. Mark, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mark, first of all, I guess the obvious question is, why Uruguay?
Well, funnily enough, I'm actually speaking to you today from Sheffield. I'm actually back at my parents for a couple of weeks. But I've not lived in England for about 12 years. And prior to Uruguay, I lived with my German wife in Berlin. And we just decided to kind of take a little flyer for a while and sat down one afternoon with a couple of laptops and thought, well, where could we live and what do we need? And we figured out that we only really needed good internet so we could go anywhere. And we looked at the globe of the world and kind of homed in on South America, and certain places weren't going to be suitable for a sort of number of reasons. And Uruguay just popped out as somewhere that was really safe, really stable, had great weather for 6 to 8 months of the year, was reasonable to live. And so we kind of just took it to its logical conclusion and headed out there.
And how long did it take you to settle in and feel at home?
Pretty quickly. You know, I think when I remember leaving Sheffield for Berlin, which was my first move in 2000, and the first few months were really bad. I mean, I felt terribly homesick and everything seemed different. But once you've done it once, every subsequent move from Berlin, we moved to Italy and back to Berlin and then to Uruguay, seems pretty easy. I mean, the journey to Uruguay was not the best in the world because we left Berlin in a blizzard with a very large cat. And so we ended up taking 3 flights to get to Uruguay, and it was a 24-hour journey with cat.
So when you got there, I mean, you're in the music business. Is there a good music scene in Uruguay?
No, not at all. I think one of the things that appealed about Uruguay is that culturally, it's 20 years behind, so it's a lot softer. There's not the aggressive Simon Cowell, instantaneous, everything's touchable and everybody can be famous feel, which is something that I would, you know, stand up and fight against to my dying breath.
The downside of that presumably being that there's also no infrastructure of institutions or people familiar with what it is you're trying to do.
Yes, I mean, you know, let's be very candid. Uruguay has really great internet. And if it didn't, then International Field couldn't exist. You know, International Field doesn't exist because of Uruguay in terms of infrastructure, although the feel and the vibe of the country is very important. You know, I remember getting there in the first month or two. It was the end of summer, driving around the coast, you know, listening to a lot of, I suppose you would call, Balearic music. And I think a very simple way to describe Uruguay is Ibiza in South America.
But does it have the sort of attendant party lifestyle on top of that, or is that something else the locals are 20 years behind on?
No, it really does. I mean, the population of Punta del Este swells from 20,000 year-round in January and February to 500,000. And it has an incredible party scene, but it's not one that I would really aspire to. You know, the kind of bars and restaurants are playing the Café Del Mar chill-out sound, which I don't think really, after José Padilla left Café Del Mar, is pretty representative of Balearic music. And at the sort of faster tempo end, you've got big room house. And I don't think people like Swedish House Mafia make music. They make ringtones.
Okay, well, we're going to hear the first of the tracks you've picked for us today. This is Locosolus, if I've pronounced that correctly.
Can you Locosolus.
Locosolus. Can you introduce briefly Locosolus, and then we'll play some of his track?
Well, Locus Solus is a band project of Cambridge expatriate who's now based in Venice Beach, DJ Harvey, who was also known as a cult leader and is probably the most famous underground DJ in the world.
I like the also known as a cult leader, as if that's something you can do in your spare time.
Yeah, not by him. He's a very unassuming, fantastically down-to-earth guy, but there's a whole cult. Let's put it this way. When he tours Japan, we always get asked if we want to do DJ Harvey pillowcases.
Okay, so it's a bit like that, those South Pacific Islanders who worship the Duke of Edinburgh as a god. It's not something he's actually cultivated himself.
If you're into disco and obscure music, you worship DJ Harvey, and he's famous for his 8 to 12 hour monster sets and underground parties. And this is his band project, and this version of it that you're about to hear is remixed by a guy from New Jersey called Comtruse.
I see what he's done there. Okay, well let's give that a try. This is Throwdown. Locker Solus, the Comtruse remix of Throwdown. That sounded almost New Order-ish to me. There's that kind of weird, miserable disco vibe about it.
Well, the original is much less synthy, and Comtruse is this guy from New Jersey who's really picked up on a lot of 80-isms, and he's part of, I think you would call it, the chill wave scene. You know, people like him and other kind of acts that have come out of the sort of American college indie scene, but with synthesizers rather than guitars. And it, you know, this whole kind of recording onto VHS tapes to get a certain quality of the music and buying lots of old analog synthesizers. So it's a really perfect blend of a sort of good song mixed with really interesting future retro production.
You're a subscriber to that slight Luddite tendency yourself, aren't you? You're a big fan of vinyl and not such a fan of social networking.
Yeah, I just think, you know, if you apply that ethos to record labels, anybody can start a digital record label. And I'm a big supporter of real things. I'm a big supporter of tactility as one of the senses, and you don't get that with zeros and ones. You don't get that with manufactured pop artists. You don't get it with manufactured trance music or much of what you would call big room house music that just, you know, to coin a phrase I used earlier, sounds like ringtones.
Well, the next track you have queued up for us is Beppu Ngali from Botswana. Introduce him or her or they briefly.
Or him. He is, Beppu Ngali is from Botswana. He has an Italian father and a Botswana mother. He traveled around Africa a lot because his parents were in engineering. He spent his teenage years in Lagos in Nigeria, which is obviously famous for the Femikuti Afrobeat sound, and he picked up a lot on that. And he learned a lot of different instruments, from organ to bass to percussion. And then when he moved back to Habaloni, which is the capital of Botswana, he put a little touring band together. And I got introduced to this track from a record collector who I met in a flea market in Buenos Aires. And I eventually tracked Beppu down via a sort of secondhand mobile phone in the Botswanan capital. And this is a result of it, which is an absolutely fantastic track. It came out in early summer. It's been a very big track for us this year. It had great remixes from Todd Turger and Tim Love Lee, and here it is. Thank you.
So you work with all these amazing artists from all over the world, but you're based in Uruguay. So do you tend to invite them over to Uruguay? And do you have a kind of percolating sort of scene down there that you're creating?
Absolutely not. I mean, Uruguay's been a base, and it's high-speed internet being a godsend. But it's a little far for most people to come. I mean,
it's meant to be beautiful. You can't tempt them over there?
Well, some artists come down maybe as far as San Pablo or San Paulo, as you guys call it, to DJ. But even from there, it's another 3 hours down to Uruguay. So mostly from Europe, it's a 24-hour door-to-door journey, and it's just a little bit too far for most people.
I think you have to set up a festival there. I think you've got to bring them out there.
They, you know, who did they have? Who's that other ringtone guy? David Guetta. They had him down there last January. You know, but there's not really the market or the developed scene beyond this big room, very obvious, you know, Argentinian teenagers going Larry for a month in January scene. It's not like Ibiza where you've got everything from that and then all the underground secret beach parties and full moon parties and tribal drumming parties and everything in between. It's just not that developed.
Well, Mark, we'll go to the last track you have for us now. This is I Feel Studio. So you introduce this one for us, if you will.
Well, this is me. The original idea behind the record label was to release my own music, and then I got sent so much good music, my own music got put on hold quite a lot. So I decided to push back against that with the I Feel Studio project, which is my love of 70s obscure European library music. And this track is called Morgengruß 3, or if we've been very German, Morgengruß 3. And it was originally done by a German progressive band of the 70s called Popol Vuh, and this is my interpretation of it. And it's a version I actually recorded via Skype over the internet. I was in Uruguay, and the band, which is Richard Hawley's backing band, were in Sheffield. And this is it.
That's Morgengruß 3, a reimagining of the Popol Vuh track by Richard Hawley's backing band and I Feel Studio, owned and operated by Mark B, who has been our musical guest this afternoon. Mark B, thank you very much for joining us. Mark B, founder of International Feel Records. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And earlier in the show, we heard Nelly Gacheva's global recommendations for the weekend, but it's time now to pick just one city from around the world and delve slightly deeper into its cultural calendar.
And today, it's the turn of Hong Kong. So if you're in the city this weekend, here's some special things our bureau chief Liv Lewichnik recommends.
Hong Kong's culture program is packed this weekend. Two standout exhibitions include a photography retrospective of Pulitzer Prize-winning German war journalist Horst Faas at the Foreign Correspondents Club and the VA Gallery's Made in China exhibition. It showcases contemporary prints and sculptures by leading Chinese artists from today. Have a coffee break at cafe and film bookshop Kubrick in Yamate and watch the screening of The Chair, the 1959 adaptation of the Russian tome The 12 Chairs, at Broadway Cinematheque just next door. For a whip around the city, pop by Hong Kong's newest bakery, Poe's Atelier in Sheung Wan, for a taste of some Swedish-inspired buns and breads. And for those keen on shopping, have a look at the new venture by interior design firm Eclectic Cool in Aplei Chau. There's lots of quirky vintage pieces, accessories and stationery there. Another new addition is Japanese leatherware shop Tsuchiya Bag in the Star Street area. And for a dose of music, the Fringe Club hosts a night of live reggae, indie and folk music tonight. And why not continue the Saturday night revelries at our favourite bars, 001, and onto a nightcap of whiskey at Executive in Causeway Bay. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
We'll be visiting another global city next week here on The Review. Up next today, with the Frieze Art Fair fast approaching in London, we'll be discussing what exhibitions are worth a visit. Stay tuned.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This she makes me wanna dance. Is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block. Music on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Muller.
And to close today's show, we're talking art. And with the Frieze Art Fair just around the corner here in London, we thought we would take a look at some of the exhibitions which are just opening here in the city.
Joining us in studio to give us his critical take on a few of the gallery highlights here in London is Ben Luke, art writer and contemporary art critic for the London Evening Standard. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you.
There have been quite a few openings recently in London that are going to be sort of run the course right through Frieze. And I wonder if you can talk to us about some of those.
Well, I think one of the highlights of the week that's just gone is the Cy Twombly exhibition at the Gagosian Gallery in Britannia Street in King's Cross. And it's particularly significant because it's his very last paintings. And I think that's... always something which is very interesting about artists, about their final works. And it's a continuation, really, of a body of work which he produced in 2010. But nonetheless, there's an amazing sort of fizzing energy that comes forth from the walls of the gallery.
It's a great space, the Gagosian room, isn't it? So does it do justice to his paintings?
I think that's the thing, you know, the Britannia Street Gallery, if listeners haven't been, they must go. It's one of the best spaces in London. And the great thing about it is the natural light. Mm-hmm. And paintings always look better in natural light. You know, Jackson Pollock painted by natural light. His paintings gain, you know, 50% from being shown in natural light. And I think that's very much the case with Twombly too. These paintings are brightly coloured anyway. These incredible, even the greens, you know, traditionally a cool colour, the greens fizz, you know, and then you've got red and yellows and oranges on top, and it's just an incredible energy that pours forth from these paintings.
You mentioned that these were Twombly's later works, and he was, of course, a long-running favourite of the Gagosian Gallery, and Gillian was asking there whether the space does justice to the paintings, but do these last paintings of his do justice to the space?
They do. I mean, I think the space is halved because there were only eight paintings in the show, so it isn't that full enormous space that you often get at the Gagosian. But nonetheless, even in this rather discreet space, it does do justice to the space. There's a wonderful, you know, the best kind of installations are where the space and the art meet together perfectly, and I think that happens here.
Now, these are his last paintings. What do you think they say about him at the end of his life, in his artistic life?
I think, you know, they say that he was an artist who managed to maintain his energy right up to his very last days. I mean, if you know, these are 2.5
meters. Not a quiet goodbye, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, they are incredibly energetic. And, you know, they're 2.5 meters high, 1.8 meters wide. And, you know, filling a canvas of that size, even as a young person, is pretty tricky. But, you know, a man in his 80s, it's pretty extraordinary that he was able to do this. And there is just this, you know, it's very, very gestural, these huge loops of paint and drips of paint. So, you know, it's a big physical, very gestural kind of approach to painting, which he maintained till his last days, clearly.
I mean, how do you think they compare to his earlier works? Do you think he was actually one of those rare artists who was actually improving as he got older, or was he? Or is there an element of diminishing returns?
I think he's one of those artists that was able to maintain his power right the way through his career. His early works are much more sort of scratchy. He used to carve into gesso. They would be much more bitty. And then, you know, sort of towards the end of the 70s and through the 80s, 90s, until the end of his life, he got a lot more painterly, a lot more romantic, you could say, and he maintained the quality of his work right the way through. And you know, some critics are quite sort of sniffy about his later work, but I find it very powerful. And the colour really comes to the fore in the later work. And you know, he is one of the great colourists, I think, of the most recent decades.
I was quite intrigued because the gallery is broken up into two rooms. In one room you have the last paintings, in the other room you have some of his photography. And the interesting thing about the photography, it's not what you expect. It's very pretty and soft colours, but the way he did them, when you kind of read about it, is quite interesting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, they're very small photographs, but they're actually blown up from very even smaller photographs. They were taken on they were Polaroids, which he then essentially turned into prints, you know, through a particular method. And they are very grainy and blurry and very subtle and
kind of romantic. Like they're all, I mean, not chocolate boxy. That wouldn't be fair. But there's something very soft compared to this kind of raw graffiti art.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, these photographs of tulips, and you know, those were on the end wall of the show. And the wonderful thing about the tulip photographs, I thought, was that on the one hand they looked like paint. You know, these tulips looked like they were painted,
and they also not by him.
Yeah, exactly. And yet they also looked like flesh as well. And I thought that was the really powerful thing about them, that was that they were they are very romantic and in some ways traditional. They're traditional subjects in a way, but at the same time there's a depth about them and a poetic quality to them, which I think is very, very strong.
I also wanted to ask about the exhibition at the Hayward. This is New Directions from China, which I believe impressed you.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it's a really interesting show. I don't think it's an entirely successful show, but I think it has its real moments. I think the thing about this Hayward show is I think that a lot of the art that we've seen that has come from China has been very post Young British Artist work. You know, it's clear that Young British Artists made an impact on the Chinese scene, and there was a lot of people who saw the kind of successes that Damien Hirst and his ilk had had and sought to emulate it through shock and through dramatic sort of advertising type gestures.
The Young British Artists, sorry to interrupt, do of course have a luxury that Chinese artists don't, which is freedom to, you know, pickle dead sharks and make skulls out of diamonds if they feel like it. But how much of this new Chinese art is reflective or even acknowledges some of the strictures within which they must operate?
There's a lot of political critique in the show, but it's often done in a kind of it's not sledgehammer political content. It's
Is
much
that
more
because
subtle.
It can't be, or because they actually prefer subtlety.
I think one of the things it's a good point, because I think one of the important things about this show is it suggests a current of Chinese art that perhaps isn't widely acknowledged and isn't very well established, which in a way it's a political gesture just to make a piece of performance art. It wasn't acknowledged in the canon. It was seen as something which was in some way, it was an act of anti-government propaganda just to make a performance. And so there's a lot of performance art. There's a lot of live art in this show. There's a piece by Ying Mai Duan, where you go into a little room which has got these trees and leaves on the floor, and you approach her, and she comes towards you and takes these pieces of paper out of her pocket and looks through them and then hands you one. And my one said, "Do you know any Chinese fairy tales? Can you send them to me in a letter?" And so there's these sort of very strange setups in the show. And just these, you know, for me it was a real revelation to see a lot of work which really has been off the radar. And I hadn't in any way seen before. So I think that was a really good revelation about it. One of the things that I didn't like about the show was that right from the start, I was followed around as part of a performance piece. So somebody, a girl in pyjamas, followed me around the entire show and literally stayed with me right to the end. And I tried all sorts of devices. You know, I didn't know if, for instance, if I was to politely request that she didn't follow me, that she would go away. She didn't. She stayed with me. And so all the time that I was looking at the art in the show, there was this person behind me. And that was a kind of a strange off-putting element to the show, I have to say.
Ben Luke, art writer and contemporary art critic for the London Evening Standard, thank you very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of this instalment of the Saturday Review. The show was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Ben Jay, and we're also very grateful to AK Pericorpi for her help. Next week, we'll be asking what TV people around the world have been tuning into with Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast.
Stay tuned for The Curator next, where you can catch our Pick of the Week, the best of Monocle 24's stories, guests and location reports. And don't forget to tune in to The Monocle Weekly on air Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Thanks for listening.